Hi, James. I'm really happy to have you here today, that you have found some time in your busy schedule.
Yeah, man, it was only a challenge. We only had to postpone, what, three or four times? Your travel, my travel, everything in the world.
Yeah, that's life. What we can do. But finally, we are here, and I have some questions prepared for you that I'm really curious about your answers. And I wanted to start off something super simple. For a warm-up, because you are in the industry in IT and tech for many, many years, I would say. So you have seen everything, you have done many things. So I'm just wondering about the typical challenges of a chief architect. How do you see it?
Oh, it's interesting, to your point, when I started in IT, it was mainframes and TTYs and terminals and, the idea that you could put something in your pocket that had the power of anything smaller than a full room was kind of a fantasy out of Star Trek and other fantasy novels. Over time, certainly things have gotten reinvented in smaller and smaller forms. And I always think it's funny because folks are like, "Oh, look, they've reinvented something, or they came up with something new." And you look at it hard enough, and you say, "No, not really. It's just really this replatformed and reshoved into something." At one point, some company came up with an indexed flat file that they could use to store offline records, and I'm like, "Wait, IBM had that. It was called ISAM." It's funny. So the challenge for a chief architect is on the one hand being able to articulate to the business what the technology can do for them and why it matters. And on the other hand, it's kind of playing whack-a-mole with the developers to keep them on the straight and narrow, to try to keep them in the lane that you've given them. A lot of times what you find is everybody wants to be the architect and everybody's the smartest guy on the block. And if you don't tell developers what you really want, the fidelity to your vision is going to drift, and it's a question of how much drift you can tolerate. And over the years, I've seen projects that have drifted 10%, and I've seen projects that have drifted 90%. And the 90% drift ones are a lot harder to recover than the ones that are in the 10 or 20% drift range. So, I think overall, it's always been a challenge of getting the developers to understand why you exist and what the benefit is of what you're giving them, the governance, the vision, the ability to hone in on something that they can share and work. I have a question for you, Matt. I've always discovered that code is only reusable in the first person, as in my code is always reusable, and never in the third person, as in your code is never reusable. Have you discovered that to be true as well?
To be honest, I never thought about
Well, every developer I ever talk to will tell me how reusable his code is, how great it is, how they've got a grip. And every person who ever looks at that code after that goes, "What was he thinking? No, I can't reuse this." So, that's what the architect really does, is tries to get enough reusability so more than one person agrees it's reusable.
So you try to be pragmatic
You
as
have
an
to be.
architect,
You have
right?
to be. The real danger that I see with architecture in general is getting too prescriptive and too far down in the weeds. You have to be a visionary. You have to be a leader. You have to be able to give some pragmatic direction. If you get too caught up in, I think the W3 standard of time is appropriate and we need to have it down to the millisecond, you've probably lost your way. There's room for data architecture and people to go ahead and specify that. But if you're the chief architect and the thing you're hung up on is what your date format is, you're probably not a chief architect.
Yeah, makes sense. And how about the new stuff? I mean, I wanted to talk about the Copilot, ChatGPT, AI. I know that you are into something here and you are working on it.
I've been playing with it a lot. I've actually been pretty impressed. And the example I use is I started playing on a side hustle that I put together called Happy Hippo. And Happy Hippo is a piece of software that is now actually in existence and probably the first thing I've written end-to-end in I don't know how long. And the basic premise was that if you could quantify human capital risk in a monetary way, so you take flight risk, you know, Matt's going to quit, and say, oh, crap, if we replace Matt, how long will it take us and how much will it cost us? And you start to say, well, it's 2.5 to 5 times the salary that we pay Matt before Matt's going to be productive again. Well, when I started playing with this idea, I kind of said after 30 years in the industry, the world has advanced so far, there ought to be some magic beans out there to figure out. And, you know, to an extent, Amazon brought magic beans because, you know, you think about it, all this stuff of doing serverless or doing managed service and stuff like that feels a little magical because you're no longer installing the OS and installing the piles on top of it and configuring it. You're just doing. So I'm like, okay, I had recently come off a gig after my long time at ADP of working for a small company doing compliance and security. And they were all serverless and Lambda and everything was kind of cool. So I'm like, okay, we'll go down this road. So I wrote some serverless application stuff and couldn't understand where my 500 internal errors were coming from. The main thing I could produce from a Lambda was a 500 internal error. So when I stumbled on GPT-4, I said, okay, let me play a little bit. And I fed it the errors I was getting and the code I was getting. And it said, hey, moron, do this. And I did it, and suddenly my Lambda started working. So I had spent a couple of months blocked trying to figure out where this 500 was coming from. And then 2 weeks after I picked up GPT, I had 50 Lambdas up and running and working the way I wanted. And I'm just like, holy crap. You know, it was a magic beans moment because as an architect, I understand almost all of the technology at a capability level. But I'm not syntactically proficient at JavaScript. I'm not syntactically proficient at, you know, pick your language. But with ChatGPT's help, it says, hey, you know, you have an extra curly brace. Hey, you need a comma. And magically, you know, my code's running. And it was really kind of, I kind of think of it as almost like a superpower. You know, maybe you've gone out bike riding and now you've ridden on a pedal assist bike, an e-bike. And suddenly you find out you can ride further, faster, longer. It's like a superpower. Well, GPT-4 and some of the other variants, I'm not quite as cool and hip on. I'm not quite sold on Claude yet. I really think 4 is probably where it's at for the moment. It felt like a superpower. It felt like being able to move through those piles of Amazon documentation. You know, even there, I was doing my deployment work, working out how to do a SAM deploy. And I'm working through it, and it's like, okay, this doesn't make sense. Hey, GPT, what about this? Oh, change this to that and do it this way. And there's a danger. GPT lies. GPT hallucinates. GPT makes mistakes. But if you can do troubleshooting and understand how to break things down and incrementally build, it can help you a huge amount. You just can't say, go build me everything. Because if it's anything more than a trivial everything, it's not going to work, and you're going to go into debug hell. But we all know debug hell. We don't like it.
So tell me more about this project, how this is helping you or other leaders to whom you introduce it.
Well, it's helping me in two ways. One, it's helping me by helping me renew some of my hands-on skills and helping me work through the logistics of building and putting together. For others, what it's doing is CHROs and other high-end HR executives tend to be a crowd that ends up talking touchy-feely stuff with the rest of the board or with the rest of the C-suite. They can't always put a dollar quantification on. So by using a combination of flight risk algorithms, which, you know, IBM Watson had one 20 years ago, the flight risk itself isn't novel or new, but then taking it and monetizing it and then trying to put it into a decision framework. And what I've done is I've kind of built it up to be a little, I hate the word, but maybe a little expert system-y. So it helps coach the manager to say, hey, Joe's in trouble. He wants to, he's going to leave soon because you're not paying him the going rate. You're not doing this. You're not doing that. And it suggests to you, maybe you ought to have the CEO give him a shout out. Maybe you ought to assign him a special project. Let him take Fridays off for a little while. You know, do something to intervene and try to bring him back. It also does a lot of pay equity type of stuff, where it will go ahead and look at jobs across locations and across genders and races and make sure that you're paying equitably. Because, you know, we all like to think the same job pays the same money, but we all know the reality is that from the last 50 years that, you know, women are paid historically less than men for the same role. We also have some implied prejudices or biases that get brought in that are not above the line, but below the line. They're subconscious. I don't know if you've ever read Danny Kleinman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. It talks a lot about System 1 and System 2 thinking. And we all like to think, oh, no, we're up in the mammalian brain. We're being very rational. We're being very, you know, considered in all our decisions. And what Kleinman did was show us that we're very reactionary and much more reptilian. And a lot of what we're reacting to, we never even think about. We just react. So if you think about how managers handle people, they're thinking they're mammalians, but they're acting like reptilians, and they're not necessarily making the switch. So by giving some objective oversight, and the software also goes as far as building scorecards for managers, so you can see, are they retaining their people? Are they taking action? Because there's a huge blind spot. I've run across a lot of managers over my career who say, oh, he's not going anywhere. Don't do anything about it. He's not going to quit. And then a month later, they're saying, oops, he quit. And there's, you know, a couple of things that come there. One is, if you have a manager who has such a big blind spot that his people walk away and he doesn't see it coming, well, you either need to retrain him or reassign him or replace him or something. The other thing is that if these managers have these blind spots, you should be knowledgeable enough to figure that out and help intervene and say, you know, hey, you know, Matt, last month you told me that if Jim quit, it was no big deal. It was not regrettable attrition. Here you are this week crying in your soup about how it's the worst thing ever. Or last month you were here telling me I can't afford to lose him. Give me money. I need to give him a raise. And now this month you're saying it's no big deal he left. So getting people on the record for some of this stuff and having a history of, was it a problem? Was it not a problem? Do you matter? Does it not matter? Helps identify those blind spots and helps people address the human side of execution more readily. And every CEO knows that if he doesn't have people to execute the work in his plan, he's not going to meet the plan. You know, if your guy says, I'm going to grow revenue by 100%, well, okay, are you doing that through a winning lottery ticket, or are you doing that by hiring people, managing people, and delivering value? It's most likely the latter. And if your managers aren't aligned to the hiring and getting what you need out of them, you're basically suffering from a lack of clarity, which is why the ultimate tongue-in-cheek joke of Happy Hippo is the first product is called Clarity. And it's about giving clarity to your business and clarity to insight on how you're managing your people.
That's a really valid point. I mean, the clarity, and I have a question that I wanted to ask you about the context and the question, like the basic question, why we are doing something for the software developers. Because I feel that you think that the why is really crucial for the engineering to understand it, right? Or they are doing something.
Yep. And you know, that's one of the tricks that I've seen over and over in my career is there's always been a disconnect between business domain and software domain. And in many businesses, they felt that they just need developers, their business analysts or their product owners or whatever you want to call them this year, will know enough to tell the developer what that button's supposed to do and everything. And inevitably, that can work at a certain scale, but it falls apart after time because the developer needs to go make decisions without you sitting next to them. And if they understand the business context and they understand the business domain, they go a lot further, faster. then if they keep having to go back to the PO and says, okay, well, what happens when I get this? Okay, what happens when I get that? So, you know, you might tell I'm not entirely an Agile fan. I like it conceptually because it's about time boxing and getting things done. But somewhere along the way, we kind of lost business analysts and developed product owners. And the product owner feels like they're supposed to do the broad brush, but they don't do the minutia. And the business analyst used to be very good at the minutia. And I haven't really seen where that role has come back in anywhere. The product owners kind of figure it's the engineer's problem. The engineer figures, if it wasn't specified, I don't worry about it. And we end up with more breakage and more cycles and more problems.
And recently when we talk about the highly distributed teams. Because I'm in a business for 10 years, I work with distributed teams. I run the company with the teams based in Poland. But you mentioned you work with plenty of them. And I'm just wondering, in your case, what are the biggest challenges here and how you address it?
Well, when I first started my career at ADP and IBM, it was all pretty much, you know, on-site teams that work together. Everybody in the room, we're going to whiteboard it on a, you know, room-sized whiteboard and argue about it and then go off and build it and come back. That worked great when the teams were 10 and 20. I think my happiest times were when the team was 10 and they were all in one location because we could actually get some clarity and some certainty about what it was we were doing and had shared purpose. The esprit de corps was strong. As you get into larger and larger teams, you start to get the telephone game. And I always relate this, you're probably too young for this, but there was an era in time when we used to add more and more CPUs to hardware. And you'd go from having two CPUs to four to six to eight to 16. And the goal was always, oh, if I go to four, I have four times as much CPU as I had when I started. And the reality was because of cache missing and communications overhead and all the coordination that went on, you didn't get a straight linear, you know, 4X. You got something that trailed off very badly. So with two CPUs, you got 1.5. With four CPUs, you got 2.75 to 3. You know, it really fell off quickly. So there was a loss as you went up. It's the same thing with developers as you go to more and more locales. You don't scale linearly because you have more and more communication overhead, more and more clarification, more and more need to specify things and document them more explicitly so that the remote team doesn't get it wrong. The biggest disappointment for me has been that our collaboration software has not come further. You know, the shared whiteboards we have are pretty lame. Our ability to do like a whiteboarding in the room session with remote people. You know, I always hoped that when we started to see VR or when we started doing avatars or we started doing all this stuff, we'd get to the point where you could be in a virtual room and do a virtual whiteboard that people would actually engage with and participate in. And the reality is we really haven't gotten there. I've run across a couple of startups who've done it with second devices and some software. Miro was a company that was doing very well with like a shared whiteboard design space. Stuff like that was starting to get there. But, you know, the biggest challenge I've seen with distributed teams is really the level of documentation and the overhead. You know, that's really the bottom line. Now my team's totally remote. I manage a group of 20 people in India. I have nobody close to me. I've never met them in person. although I'm going to India this year, I swear. I have the ticket. I'm just waiting for the timing to work out. I've been carrying a ticket since last December that I haven't been using yet. But, you know, larger and larger projects have this problem. And I think that it's really not so much distributed or not. I'm sure if we talked to somebody who worked for the DOD back during Apollo, when they were writing massive amounts of code to fit into a tiny processor on a spacecraft, they probably had the problem of too many teams doing too many things in coordination as well. You know, we've just broken it up and put it across the internet and made it so we're now more geographically distant.
I see that you're a huge believer in a distributed kind of model of working. And I'm just wondering, what do you think, what are your thoughts on the return to the office movement that is recently quite popular in a big
sense? I think it's somewhat foolish. I think that the mistake that people are making is they're thinking that their managers will be better if the people are in the building. I think the real fall down here is that too many managers equate people sitting with people being productive, and that the real place we need to upskill is the managers who are managing those remote teams to make sure they understand how to engage with their people, how to judge the outputs they're getting, and how to keep them, you know, pulling the oars in the right direction. I really don't think being in the room together on a daily basis is really necessary. That said, I wouldn't say that having team building together once a quarter or once a month or once per unit time, I think is still valuable. I think you need to have relationships with the people. But I think the work itself, the serendipity is kind of oversold. You can be motivated and work through ideas with people who are across the wire or across the room. You just need to have creative people.
And as a techie there, I'm always looking for some lessons learned. So I assume you could have a lot of lessons learned. But to the listeners, if you think about the most valuable, most important lessons learned as a tech leader for you, could you share it, like through your career? What was it?
I think the most important lesson I've learned is to empower your people and trust them, give them direction, and then correct them privately and praise them publicly. And I know that sounds a little weird, but when you correct them publicly, they lose face and they lose confidence and you undermine them. And you really can't afford to undermine your people because that lasts a lot longer. You know, coaching is really not about public embarrassment. You know, the other great thing I've learned is if you're ever in a room and you're the smartest person in the room, find a bigger room. Because it's always a danger if you're the smartest person in the room, because you're going to get a lot of groupthink and a lot of echo, and nobody's going to challenge you. So I go out of my way to make sure that the people who work with me and for me understand that I can be wrong too, and you need to go ahead and make sure my understanding is correct. At ADP, we had a love of McKinsey, which I never could quite understand. But the one thing that they did teach me well was the obligation to dissent. So if you're in a discussion, somebody's got to take the opposing view. Somebody's got to play devil's advocate and says, well, what if we're wrong? Well, what if our assumptions are incorrect or off by an order of magnitude? And if nobody's doing that, you're going to end up in a really bad place, because you're not going to recognize that when you add that extra order of magnitude of users, or you go from 100 rows to 1,000 rows or 10,000 rows in that table, that it's either going to fall off a cliff or it's not going to work. Or, you know, the other main thing I always push for is who's your end user? Who is this Superman you think you're building for? And I tortured a lot of security vendors on this over the years, who would bring me this code scan stuff that would output, you know, reams and reams of CVEs and CVSS type of stuff. And I would ask them, who is your end user? Who do you believe is going to be able to comprehend this data and make use of it? And many times it's, no, we're just being thorough. Well, no, you're not being thorough. You're being arrogant, because you're not connecting to the person who has the workflow and the function they need to build. So, you know, I'm very much into this idea of building for personas and building for business value chains that have value on their own that makes sense, rather than building the Sears and Roebuck catalog of, you know, the 20th century online, where you say, I've got everything here. I have a left nav that's 3 pages long that leads me into 100 functions. Now, what function did you want? I'm sure I cover it. It's like, no. I've got a security champion who needs to know what the status of their project is. I should come in. I should see a scorecard. I should see a dashboard. I should have an ability to drill into what the highest issues are. I shouldn't just see a list of prioritized crap that I can't work through. You know, we don't really think about cognitive load on the people who are using what we build. And that's one of the main things I think you have to do.
James, thanks for that. That's a really valuable lessons, I think, for everybody in the business. And I have last question that I wanted to ask. Do you have any book recommendations, maybe resources, podcasts, or conferences that have been particularly helpful to you on your tech leadership journey?
At various points in my career, they've been different books and different times. So, yes. You know, I really enjoyed Gene Kim's book on, you know, DevOps early on, and that helped a lot for getting my grip on, okay, what does DevOps even mean? You know, I really enjoyed Adam Shostak's book on threat modeling. He's the Microsoft guy who came up with the elevation of privilege game. And when I shifted gears, when I left ADP to do compliance and InfoSec, learning about threat modeling and understand how that whole process worked was amazing because, you know, it turned out that the argument isn't let the security guys rule, it's go ahead and define what your threat model is and live with it. And a lot of people don't do that. I also found, obviously, Dan Kleiman's book on Thinking Fast and Slow to be very good because it helped me understand that as a leader, I still have blind spots. And inevitably, if you're not willing to admit you have blind spots and have a need to learn, you fall into a very bad cycle of confirmation bias, and you become the only one in the world who's right. And a little hint for you, Matt, if the whole world's wrong and you're right, you might want to double check your thinking. The law of large numbers says that it's unlikely that a 200 million people are wrong and one person is right. It just doesn't hold up.
That's a beautiful dot, let's say, at the end of our interview, I think. That's a great what you said. So, Jim, thank you so much for today. Thank you for your insights and your lessons there. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate the time.